Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 50. Keeping the Faith. From the days of her first struggle with Richard Kennedy to maintain the integrity of her teaching, Mrs. Eddy had always regarded this as the great field of her warfare. Attacks upon herself and upon her doctrine, from the point of view of the Orthodox religionist, might seem to occupy a larger and more frequent place in the limelight of her life. But in her own mind, she never seems to have had the least doubt but that the real enemy of the cause at all times was the false prophet. Richard Kennedy, Edward Arons, Josephine Woodbury, to mention a few of the most outstanding, constituted the only serious menace she seemed to feel, not as individuals, but as the "lo here and lo there" of mortal mind, as she would have put it, which could and would, if not resisted, deceive even the elect. In the next friend's suit, she had won a final victory over the enemies of her person, over those who sought to restrict her liberty and abridge the rights and privileges of her movement. She had still to measure swords in an equally momentous struggle with the false Christ, in the, for her, broadest possible meaning of the term. The scene of it all was New York, and the central figure, one of Mrs. Eddy's oldest and most devoted students, Augusta Stetson. Augusta Stetson, it will be remembered, had gone to New York at Mrs. Eddy's request as far back as 1886 in order to start the Christian Science movement there. From the first, she had been successful, and more than successful. A woman of striking personality and tremendous force of character, she had literally carried all before her and gone from strength to strength. From a room over a drugstore at the corner of Fifth Avenue and 47th Street, she had moved her church steadily at intervals to more commodious quarters. From the room over the drugstore to Crescent Hall at 138 Fifth Avenue in 1890. To Hardman Hall on the corner of 15th Street 2 years later. And from Hardman Hall in 1894 to the Scottish Rites Hall in Madison Avenue and 29th Street. Thence in 1896 to still more commodious quarters at 145 West 48th Street. Finally, in 1899, unable to obtain sufficient accommodations in any other way, it was decided to build a church of such a size as to meet all reasonable needs of the near future. And to this end, a lot was purchased at the corner of Central Park West and 96th Street. There was nothing in all this to occasion any misgivings at first. Between Mrs. Eddy and Augusta Stetson, there seems to have existed for years a very real affection and mutual admiration. There was, however, between the two, this fundamental difference, that whereas Mrs. Eddy was ever attaining to clearer views of the ultimate of her teaching, and was always ready to abandon a practice the moment she saw that it tended to impede progress towards this ultimate, Augusta Stetson, like many others, remained through the years exactly at the point of her entrance. With the more obscure of Mrs. Eddy's followers, this tendency to stultification might pass unnoticed. But Mrs. Stetson's outstanding achievements made her the center of the movement's scrutiny, so that her perpetuation of the outgrown concepts of a bygone period, namely, that day in the 80s when marriage was looked upon as something to be risen above, and one's woes were so easily attributable to telepathic bombardment by others, brought her into irreconcilable conflict with the newer generation and its less personalized doctrine. But after the die was once cast against her, the criticisms were by no means confined to these issues. Her undeniable eloquence was regarded by her detractors, who were perhaps not so articulate, as symptomatic of arrogant vainglory. And every questionable pronouncement she made was transmitted promptly to Boston and to Chestnut Hill. She was quoted as telling her students, "We need health and strength and peace, and for these we look to God. But let us not forget that we also need things, things which are but the type and shadow of the real objects of God's creating, but which we can use and enjoy until we wake to see the real. We surely need clothes. Then why not manifest a beautiful concept? Clothes should, indeed, be as nearly perfect as possible in texture, line, and color. It is certain, too, that we need homes. Then why not have beautiful homes? Our homes should express the highest sense of harmony and happiness. If we have a carpet, why not a beautiful, perfect one, instead of a dingy, half-worn one? We have a right to everything that is convenient, most comfortable, most harmonious. God made all things. Though we only see their shadows, and all things are for His children. Everything is ours. It does not belong to mortal mind." This, said her critics, elevated money-making and the ability to make money to the point where it was regarded as the supreme test of understanding. A case was in the building. Her individualistic speech and manner were cited as departures from what were becoming the canonical writings of the Church. And the initiative with which she built her New York church became a sign of inordinate ambition. All this led readily into the ancient charge of aspiring to displace the God-ordained leader of the movement. Worse still, she was accused, and she never denied the accusation, of taking up her enemies by name and working mentally to destroy these incarnate evils which she declared inimical to the cause. There can be no question that Augusta Stetson knew all about the downfall of so many of her distinguished predecessors through such backstairs gossip. The Julia Field Kings, the Arthur True Buswells, the Clara Choates. But with her superior intelligence, indomitable will, and closer friendship with Mrs. Eddy, she should be able to weather the storm. Anyway, far and above all these considerations, she had unquestioning faith in the absolute infallibility of her divinely inspired leader. And as her correspondence and subsequent events prove, she felt that in any final test, Mrs. Eddy would come to her rescue. But as Gussie's church, as Mrs. Eddy called it in her letters, flourished ever more spectacularly, so did the disquieting stories flourish. The anti-Stetsonites saw a threat to the supremacy of the Mother Church, to the purity of the doctrine upon which the whole movement was based, and to the leadership of Mary Baker Eddy. When the great edifice at 96th Street was completed in 1903, they pointed to its unorthodox design and appointments, and to its unorthodox activities within. All around, the building had been fitted out with luxurious practitioners' rooms where clients were received, advised, and treated. While every day at noon, Mrs. Stetson was wont to have practitioners' meetings in which she gave advice not only as to how certain problems should be met, but as to how certain people whose attitude was not regarded as satisfactory should be treated and dealt with. It all seemed innocent enough and could be explained by skillful casuistry as being absolutely in line with the teachings of Mrs. Eddy. But from the first seems to have filled Mrs. Eddy herself with great misgivings. So it was not long before she formulated a bylaw which forbade practitioners' rooms being in the same building with churches. Mrs. Stetson, who always made a great point of complete obedience to her leader, immediately complied, and the practitioners' rooms at First Church, New York, were vacated overnight and remained permanently closed. The practitioners carried on their work and in the same spirit in other quarters, of course. And so things went on until the summer of 1908, when rumors began to be heard in Boston that Mrs. Stetson was seeking to elevate her church in New York to a position similar to the Mother Church in Boston, and to establish branches throughout the city. A few months later, such a scheme was discussed in the New York American, and it was said that subscriptions were already coming in to carry through the project. The announcement appeared in the New York American on November 30th. And in the issue of The Sentinel, 5 days later, instead of a simple statement as to the falsity of the report, appeared a vigorous editorial setting forth the unsound nature of the whole proceeding, and restating the fundamental organization of the movement, wherein there was one Mother Church and its branches. Mrs. Stetson met the situation by a statement through the New York Times in its issue of December 7th, in which she declared that there had never been any thought in her mind of establishing a branch church of the First Church of New York, but that, on the contrary, the new church would be styled Seventh Church, and its only connection with First Church was that the funds for the new building would be supplied by First Church. The situation was continuing to get more and more out of hand. With the principal actors coming out from behind the scenes to take up their battle positions on the open stage, what appeared to be a grave schism was developing within the church. To a public conditioned to think of the Christian Science movement as an organization, Mrs. Stetson's blatant independence was a challenge to the constituted authority that was Boston, and indeed a threat to the very integrity of the cause itself. Whatever the merits of Mrs. Stetson's stand, and whatever her personal deserts, Mrs. Eddy could not deny that she was a dangerously disturbing element, and she must have recognized that she was the only one at this time with great enough influence to cope with such a contingency. But to the venerated warrior at Chestnut Hill, any direct action must have promised a veritable Armageddon. Perhaps some sort of strategy could forestall a ruinous battle. And so, on the day Mrs. Stetson's repudiation appeared in the New York Times, Mrs. Eddy dispatched a letter to her in New York, proposing a visit together. Mrs. Stetson lost no time in accepting the invitation. She received the letter on the morning of the 8th, and the same evening took the midnight train for Boston. Early next morning, she notified Calvin Fry of her arrival, and Mrs. Eddy promptly invited her to come out to Chestnut Hill at 1 o'clock and go for a drive with her. According to Mrs. Stetson's account of the matter, and there is no reason to doubt its accuracy, Mrs. Eddy showed herself tender and understanding. When Mrs. Stetson arrived, Mrs. Eddy was already in her carriage, waiting at the door, and after greeting her kindly, insisted on sharing her robe with her. Then the two set off together. From notes found among Mrs. Stetson's papers after her death, Mrs. Eddy seems to have concentrated all her attention on dissuading Mrs. Stetson from anything savoring of inordinate or unseemly initiative. She deprecated strongly the idea of one branch church founding another branch church, and warned her to take a lesson from her, Mrs. Eddy's, own experience and the difficulties she had when she sought to relieve her students of labors rightly devolving upon them by giving them land and money to build a church when they ought to have provided both themselves. Mrs. Eddy's efforts were apparently rewarded, for within a few days after their drive together, she received a letter from Mrs. Stetson announcing that the whole project of the new church had been abandoned. So far, Mrs. Eddy evidently might feel satisfied that she had won her battle. But this would prove a forlorn hope. In the summer of the following year, Mrs. Stetson's students presented her with a gift of gold, accompanied by a composite letter which ran in part as follows. Our hearts are filled with gratitude and awe as we see in you Christianity demonstrated. May a purified life attest the endless gratitude I feel for the manifestation of the Christ you have given us. While with Mary of old, I cry, Rabboni, teacher. Your unselfish life, fast approaching the perfect idea of love, is to my hungry sense for truth the bread of heaven and the water of life. Eating this bread and drinking this water is to me eating the body of Christ and drinking his blood. The voice of the Father, Mother, God is ever speaking through you, our blessed teacher, as the manifestation of truth. Mrs. Stetson, in a covering letter to Mrs. Eddy, said she counted herself far from worthy of such adulation, and so sent it on to her with the assurance that she did so because she felt that all the devotion it contained really belonged to her forever leader. Mrs. Eddy was thoroughly aroused. She sent the letter on to the board of directors and urged them to act upon it in accordance with Science and Health and the Mother Church Manual. While to Mrs. Stetson herself she wrote, Awake and arise from this temptation produced by animal magnetism upon yourself, allowing your students to deify you and me. Mrs. Stetson replied immediately, and in that vein of complete submission with which, however, Mrs. Eddy could no longer be swayed. The board of directors had already summoned her to appear before them, and Mrs. Eddy determined to let the summons stand. About the middle of July, Mrs. Stetson appeared before the board in Boston, and a preliminary examination of the whole situation at First Church, New York, was commenced. The proceedings, however, had not gone far before Mrs. Eddy advised that the examination be suspended and the whole matter referred back to First Church, New York, for action. At this point, the first reader of the church, one Virgil O. Strickler, called upon the board in Boston and laid before them some startling claims in the form of a diary which he had kept of some of Mrs. Stetson's private meetings that he had attended. Virgil Strickler was a lawyer from Omaha. He had been healed, he said, through Christian Science, had gone through Mrs. Stetson's class and had joined First Church, New York. As first reader, he had the privilege of attending Mrs. Stetson's practitioners' meetings. And being greatly troubled at some of the proceedings at these meetings, he had kept a diary, which he now laid before the board. So serious were the claims set forth that the board continued its investigations, and during September, various practitioners, students of Mrs. Stetson, were summoned to Boston to answer inquiries. Before long, the board, satisfied that drastic action was necessary, and acting under a special provision of the manual, removed Mrs. Stetson's card and those of her practitioners from the journal, withdrew her license as a teacher, and served upon her informal notice of their findings and orders. Among these findings were that Mrs. Stetson attempted to control and to injure persons by mental means. This being utterly contrary to the teaching of Christian Science, that she was responsible for perverted sex teaching, for encouraging self-deification, and for seeking despotic control over her students. Mrs. Stetson, on receipt of this indictment, immediately turned it over to the trustees of her church for examination. And it quickly became apparent that, although the revolt against her was gaining ground rapidly, she was still sufficiently strong to secure from her trustees some formal exoneration. When this became apparent, Mrs. Eddy wrote to the chairman of her board of directors, Archibald McClellan, under the date of October 12, 1909, this directive. Beloved student, learn at once if the Mother Church can be prosecuted for suspending a student or even expelling them who is giving us so much trouble as Mrs. Stetson does, and if it can be done safely, drop Mrs. Stetson's connection with the Mother Church. Let no one know that I have written you on this subject. Lovingly yours. No dimming of that astuteness that had founded an empire and perfected the greatest crusade is here apparent. The regal Augusta was again summoned to Boston, where she was to be questioned by the board for 3 days. 10 hours the first day, 10 the second, and 6 the last. During the second session, the harried Mrs. Stetson sent word to her church in New York that Mrs. Eddy had requested us all to unite with those in our church who are supporting the Mother Church directors on the pending issue, and that she herself was now induced to believe that I may have been wrong where I felt that I was absolutely right. The day before this, December 15th, namely, at a meeting of First Church, New York, a letter was read from Mrs. Eddy, pleading for loyalty to the board in this momentous question. Naturally, this was oil upon the waters, for to Mrs. Stetson's opponents, such a letter could portend nothing less than her defeat. while the Stetson students had been taught to expect divinely infallible judgment from their leader, and this meant to them that their teacher must be gloriously vindicated. The reign of Augusta Stetson was over. She returned to face a hostile majority in the temple she had builded with her own hands. Her resignation from the branch church came on November 22, 1909, following close upon her public excommunication from the mother church November 18th. Defeat in Christian Science? Never. Well had Augusta Stetson learned at least this lesson from her adored teacher and forever leader. She could now write with poignant sincerity. I learned during this severe trial that the hour had come when I must see that this experience was to exalt me by severing me from material organization. I am confident that I burst the bonds which held me to a material organization when I finished my church edifice and taught truth to those who were ready to assimilate it and rise higher and build on a holy spiritual foundation. Watching over Israel, our beloved leader, Mrs. Eddy, foresaw from the summit of her spiritual vision the answer to her prayer, namely, that her child, a loyal branch of the vine, First Church of Christ Scientist, New York City, should bear fruit for immortality, lay the foundation for the church triumphant and universal, in which Christ, in his second appearing, must tabernacle in visible and tangible presence to reign on earth forever and forever. Mrs. Eddy remained her savior. Armageddon's receding thunderings were no longer audible at far-off Chestnut Hill. Here, too, the same serene satisfaction of victory prevailed, and Mrs. Eddy must have enjoyed the more tangible evidence she held that what blesses one blesses all. Surely, as she settled back into the sweet calm of that westering light of her long crusade, she might have heard these longed-for words, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant."